Welcome to Country Fried Rock, where we talk with musicians to find out what inspires their creativity. Country Fried Rock, music uncovered. My guest today on Country Fried Rock is Jimbo Mathis, who's been in the music scene for a while and continues to create and push his own limits. Morning, Jimbo. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I am fantastic. It is bright and early for a musician. I thank you for being with us.
I get up with the chickens.
You got yard birds?
Yes, ma'am. You know it.
Are they pretty ones or country ones?
They are country ones. They're a little raggly. They got to fight for their right to stay alive around here. Good talking with you.
Absolutely. You too. Well, this has been a treat because your name has been brought up repeatedly throughout our show, but really more for your producing.
Right. I'm so glad. Yeah, I did a lot of producing over the past 5 years, you know, helping other artists out and helping them get their sound like they needed it.
As I started to do a little bit of research, I realized we could talk about all different kinds of things. So let's set the stage a little bit for how you first started getting into music. Like, as a little kid, what were you into?
Yeah, well, I grew up with music in the house, you know, with my father, my uncles, my cousins. I'm talking about Northeast Mississippi, in the hill country of Mississippi, during the 70s and 80s. So, yeah, we had banjos, mandolins. I first got attached to the mandolin when I was about 6, and I started learning the rudiments, you know, of all the instruments. We had a lot of harmony singing, and music was just a part of our house, and it was a part of our weekends, you know, and just what the family did. It's some of the most fond memories, you know, you can have, really. It's just watching grown-ups get tanked on cheap beer and, like, singing like angels, you know. It's great. when you're 6 years old, and they always encouraged me, and so that's how I got into it. It was really more from just the joy and the family aspect of it. And then before, you know, ever realizing there was a business part of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, at what point did that expand for you beyond just what you were doing with your family?
Well, in high school, you know, I started branching out and I got an electric guitar and an amplifier and, you know, and wanted to rock. And this is in Corinth, Mississippi. So, actually, I had one of the very first punk rock bands in the state of Mississippi, you know, in the early 80s called Johnny Vomit and the Dry Heaves.
Great name.
And we had some 45s, you know, that you can find out there that are on Goner Records. You know?
Uh-huh.
That would be my first recorded evidence, would be Johnny Vomit and the Dry Heaves.
And so what sort of punk were you all?
We were backwoods Mississippi punks. mean, we basically had to make up our own scene. I think we saw Rock and Roll High School on, you know, HBO when
yep.
we finally got cable in the 80s. And that's when we realized that there was a thing called punk rock. We jumped in headfirst when we were teenagers. But then I always kind of latched on to original things that were different, things that were original, as well as embracing like the traditional stuff. I still do the same, you know. The traditional stuff is like my Bible, and the new and the different, that just comes from being a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always really pushed to always have my own compositions. That's what I'm usually playing, you know, for the public. Mm-hmm.
Several great musician friends of Country Fried Rock generously donated songs for a free music sampler. Download it at noisetrade.com/countryfriedrock. 19 songs to help raise awareness and money for Nucci Space, a nonprofit serving the mental health needs of musicians in the Athens, Georgia area. Find out more about Nucci's at nuci.org. From right away, you were writing your own stuff.
Yes, ma'am. I got started writing my own stuff right away after high school. I continued to do that, and just something finally just clicked in my late teens and early 20s where I was able to just start writing all my own stuff, and I've done that ever since.
Is that something that just flows for you?
It does now. I just look at it as it's like a habit thing, you know? I mean, I had encouragement in music, and I had encouragement in my family. All through the generations are known as writers and musicians and different kind of eccentrics, so they're also real smart. And so, I mean, just crazy smart people that scare you, you know. So I've got this kind of weird streak. So I practiced doing it. It kind of came out of me. Then over the years after doing it so long, now it's just a habit thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can do it pretty easily as far as the composing, writing, latching on to ideas and kind of elaborating on them. It's like carpentry or something to make it, you know, or working on a carburetor. It's just habit and it's pretty easy.
Does that tie into like a Southern literary tradition for you?
It really did, big time. big time. I've got authors in my family. Well, all of my family is based in Mississippi in the Deep South. You know, I mean, that's three generations. As soon as they were settling in Mississippi, we were here. Yeah, it really does tie in memoirs, kind of eccentric uncles and cousins who did memoirs, who did essays, poetry, and this kind of thing.
When did you discover some of those writings?
I discovered all this stuff as a child. You know, I was always into genealogy of the family, and I was always into digging around in the great-grandmother's boxes and finding postcards and stuff, you know, and asking questions about these things, you know. I started taking notes on the family genealogy, you know, when I was just a preteen, you know. I have notebooks that I kept and going through the family Bibles and stuff. So it is a Southern literary mindset. And that's tied into our history as well and to our music. You know, as far as the musical side, you know, my father was a real stickler and a great memory for lyrics. You know, and he would know all the verses to everything. And he's just got this incredible photographic memory for song lyric. And so I was brought up with all the proper lyrics, 22 verses for John Henry.
Wow.
You know, or whatever. There's a certain number that we knew. And it's like I said, it's like the canon of the Bible. You learn it and then you know it.
With the literary influence and then combined with the history and tradition of the musical history of the Deep South, where did it lead for you?
Oh, well, I mean, it just, you know, that's just being a kid with a lot of testosterone, you know, and been zits, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I just kept really I just kept on the same path, really. I know it seems sort of chaotic if you look through my catalog, but the whole time I was studying Bill Monroe. I was learning how to play Robert Johnson. I was learning how to play Charlie Patton. There's things that I didn't grow up with that I continually, as I got older and was able to, say, go to record stores and find a Elmore James record or find a Louis Armstrong record or something. And just free coincidences, then started getting out into the bigger world and being able to travel to Atlanta and other areas and see more of the world and go to, you know, Chapel Hill and look through the music stores and hear the college stations. So I was grew up in a very rural, I mean, could have been the 1950s in my town. There were no computers. There, you know, very little access to anything.
Yeah.
I had the same teachers in high school that my dad had had.
Right.
And they confused us, you know. They were like senile. You know, there was like Lone Ranger was on TV, you know. So as I got out and began to travel on my own, and I was very curious about the art scene in the world, the music scene, and I just kept putting it two and two together, kept realizing as time went on how everything really tied back into Mississippi anyway for me, through Faulkner, through the blues, through the history of slavery, Civil War history, and everything that's tied in. Just kept pointing me back as I looked further and further around and kind of saw what America was all about. I just really kept on a pretty steady path through reading and through the music.
And literally, I mean, because you ended up back there.
Correct. Correct. Hey, everybody, you're listening to Jimbo Mathis here on Country Fried Rock. And be sure and look me up on jimbomathus.com, JIMBOMATHUS.
What was continuing to push you creatively with that?
That point in time, just discovery, you know, finding out all these other things about art, theater, music. And in the Chapel Hill scene, see, I relocated myself up there in the late 80s. And I was drawn to groups that I thought were unique, like, well, R.E.M., I know they had a very literary bent, studiousness in his lyrics, but also groups like Southern Culture on the Skids, who were like really celebrating, hey, we're big old rednecks, you know, and groups like Flat Duo Jet, and who were very roots-oriented and would do things like Benny Goodman music, you know, and they kind of made it, they fit it all into a rockabilly, you know, Southern thing. I got encouragement for that, and I was like, aha. Here's a Southern new generation of people that are putting something together, and this is where I'm heading, you know, and this is my mindset. So I really identified with that in Chapel Hill and in the Athens scene, and the people were kind of looking back and doing cool stuff and knew what they were doing, you know. So I think that attracted me to that area, and that really got me started with the Squirrel Nut Zippers.
You mentioned briefly about record stores and the role that they played, especially at that time in music discovery.
Yes.
Was there a bootleg that really got you, or just something that was new to you that was like your aha album?
You know, I would have to say it would be R.E.M. Like when I was in high school, I saw them on David Letterman when Reckoning came out. I was supposed to be like banned from watching TV because I had made some bad grades. And I would sneak in the living in the basement at night and watch the bands on David Letterman. Mm-hmm. And one night, just out of the blue, here's R.E.M.
Mm-hmm.
They're all scroungy looking. They got clothes from the thrift shop and stuff. and that's kind of how me and my boys like to dress, you know?
Yeah.
And we would get stuff out of our grandparents' closets and thought it looked cool just to be different, you know? And and I was like, wow. And they had no social skills on TV. They looked uncomfortable. I thought it was the greatest thing. And then a few months later, I find out they're playing this little broken down theater up in Oxford, or over in Oxford. And my buddy and I found out about it, got tickets and came and watched them. And I just was blown away by this. I think I was in about the 11th grade. I was really impressed by how just kind of scroungy but beautiful they were. They looked horrible. They had bad amps. And they had no lighting in this old thing. There was maybe 20 people there. And this was the Reckoning tour. Yep. Just blew me away. And then I started realizing they're from Georgia, you know, and started looking up into the East Coast and the bands that were coming out of there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, in a lot of ways, you had to move to get into that culture.
I did. There was no, you know, Mississippi is caught up a lot in the past 20 years. We're talking a minute ago. But at the time, it was tough to be an original person here, especially wanting to be a musician and perform in public. There just was no outlets for that.
And it's funny because on the one hand, in the Deep South, we have such a history of music, but it's not necessarily public performance outside of the church realm.
Yeah, out of the church and the juke joints, the 80s especially, I think it was just a bad time, you know. Music had just kind of lost its way. You could still see Charlie Feathers in a old dive bar in Memphis in the 80s. If you knew about Charlie Feathers, you know what I'm saying? There were still things to be seen, but it was really, really underground. You could go to a fife and drum picnic in the hill country, you know, but I didn't know about that. No one did except the neighbors. So it was even more weird and hidden at that time. It wasn't until the 90s some of the Mississippi things like the Fat Possum Artists started being brought into the light of day. Junior Kimbrough and I was like, wow, you know, there was an old juke joint up on the farm where I used to hear this music blaring out, but you didn't think to go in there, you know, or you weren't allowed. So it was there. It was just way underground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you physically in some ways had to move in order to pursue what was pulling you creatively. Where did that take you in terms of pushing what you were thinking and pushing how you were creating and writing?
You're absolutely right. I absolutely had to move at that time. And I traveled extensively. You know, I was figured out I needed to see the world in order to kind of decide where I was going to go.
Right.
You know, it was a conscious decision. So I worked on river barges, you know, on the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
I was a deckhand and you'd work 3 to 4 weeks and you get 3 to 4 weeks off. I got this job. I'd go out there and work for a month straight. And then I would travel just by myself. I went to the West Coast of San Francisco, went to LA, and went to up the East Coast, all through the Deep South, of course. And I landed on Chapel Hill. That was just the place. It was Southern. It was quirky. I still knew I needed to be in the South. You know, I couldn't jive like I wanted to elsewhere. I needed a smaller place. God, up there, man, it was just a different world. There were libraries, there were music stores, there were music venues where all they had was original music. You didn't have a cover band in Chapel Hill.
No.
that's 180 degrees opposite from where I was from at that time.
Yeah.
So there was no such thing as a cover band. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
And the libraries, the bookstores, the access to the folklore collection up there, which was incredible. There was more than I could soak in. And so I said, hey, I'm moving here and I'm going to educate myself. So, I pulled my truck up into a little abandoned road and said, this is where I'm staying. Called the barges and said, I'm not coming back. And I just launched into it and I stayed in the bookstores and it just led me. I just was looking at everything. And the libraries had their policies up there were great. You get a library card without any kind of ID. To all the libraries on campus. So it was just fantastic. You know, I read about theater, art, books, folklore, history, and then all of them in the meantime, starting bands. And it was a great place to be at that time. Hey, everybody, you're listening to Jimbo Mathis on Country Fried Rock. Look me up on jimbomathis.com, y'all.
How did studying about all of the history of the arts, both art and theater and folklore, what did that bring to you?
Well, it just made a big palette for me to decide, you know, to draw on. I mean, music is theater too, you know, if you think of it in that way. So gave me a bigger array of knowledge, you know, when it came to presenting my music and into starting bands. Fitting in when I saw space for me, I had information I could draw on, you know, like especially with the squirrel nut zippers. I mean, all that study and all that research and all that, it's like play to me. I was like a kid in the candy shop, you know. So all I had to do was get a little job washing dishes. I could sit back there and read all day. And yeah. So it was great. I just paid for my education by washing dishes and sitting around in coffee shops, reading books and hanging out in the library. You know, with the squirrel nut zippers, it all came together. All mm-hmm. the theater, all the music, the visual components mm-hmm. of it, all the concepts that we used in that. That was the ultimate Chapel Hill, you know, component of what I did was mm-hmm. the squirrel nut zippers.
You all had a very, very creative time together.
Yes.
What continued to move you forward creatively after that time together?
I started getting more and more of a pull to come back to Mississippi. I just started needing to be back here, best way I can say it. There were so many great things that happened in Chapel Hill and in North Carolina. Like I said, every road I pursued in my creativity up there ended up leading back here. I missed it.
A distinct theme has arisen throughout this show of Southerners in particular who have had to leave home to really end up then appreciating home.
Right.
I can't say that so much for the people from other places, but the Southerners in particular, that stood out as a life force and a creative force ultimately yes. for them.
Yes. Isn't that great?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. You became one of the most well-read, self-educated, and then you took that back to Mississippi. How did that fly?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I also grew up hunting and fishing like everybody else.
Sure.
And, you know, I like living in the country, and I don't try to really wear it on my sleeve, but I use it in my own writings a lot, in my own way of thinking about things. You mm-hmm. know, it might not come up in conversation. I'm not going to sit around and pontificate about, you know, Antonin Artaud or something. Even though I know about the theater of the absurd.
Right.
You know, I just soon go catfishing, hang out in Taylor where I live, and, you know, do carpentry or just kick it. I have no trouble just kind of fitting in, or could say. A lot of the stuff I learned, I didn't need to learn, but I satisfied my own curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't want to be somebody who knew what they were talking about, even if I didn't have to say it. I really, really wanted to be genuine. I wanted to be authentic. I wanted to be the real thing. And whatever I had to do that, I loved the process of learning and
right.
seeing how art has shaped over the years and made America what it is. So I feel very comfortable where I'm at. Yes, ma'am.
It sounds to me like there's some of the older gear involved.
No, you're absolutely
Is that
correct.
Something that you're into?
You know, it's something, I'm not a real tech person. I was lucky enough through the squirrel nut zippers to have people drawn to our music that were like antique microphone and antique equipment collectors. And
right.
so I found out right away that all the old music that I liked and enjoyed was recorded on a certain type of mic and with a certain technique.
I like those ribbon mics. That's what got me into it.
That's what I use.
Gotcha.
The ribbon mics. And so I was lucky enough to, as being young and being in the studios a lot, you just
right.
kind of seeing what's going on in there. And I just quickly came to the conclusion that I liked the old school, and that's all I ever really needed to use. I was fortunate enough to get a couple of ribbons, RCA ribbons, and some German tube preamps back in the 90s, and I've just kept them and really haven't bought anything else. I just use them. But see, it puts the focus on the instruments, puts the focus on the band or the performer to do it properly.
Right.
And you don't fix it. I believe that the whole technology thing is driven by, you know, the studios and by the technology companies to make new products to sell to people. And then the real techie people snatch them up, and then they go out of date, and then, you know, they mess the music up. So they say, oh, we'll fix it later. Well, not the way I record. You know, it's on there, and you're leaving it for posterity. Mm-hmm.
At some point, the need to fix it, pulls out the human element from it.
It destroys it. Hey, Buckaroos, you're listening to Jimbo Mathis on Country Fried Rock. In the mind, in the psychology of recording, you know, it's an odd thing to do, really. Recording is frightening. It's unusual mm-hmm. for humans to do this. But to know that you can go fix it will mess your mind up. So you shouldn't think that as you're doing it, this is it. I'm putting it on the line right now. So, you know, Sam Phillips wasn't going to tell Elvis, oh, don't worry about that. We'll fix your vocal later. He was like, hey, that's it. So that's kind of my philosophy. But I'm really not a technology person at all.
Oh, boy. Yes.
Oh, boy.
And it's funny because, you know, here you are doing it your way, as they used to say. In some ways, we're all forced to be technology people, whether we want to be or not.
I'm not anti-technology in a lot of regards. I think the social media stuff is great. You can communicate easier. You know, you can download lyrics and music at any time. Now, you know, I would have to go on week-long pursuits of some album or band to even locate something, a physical copy of something in the 80s. Well, now you can just punch a button on my cell phone. Great. In the recording, not so much.
Well, so once you headed back to Mississippi, then not physically or literally, where did you go? But creatively, where did you go?
Well, I just immersed myself into the juke joint clubs. You know, just I got a little scrappy blues trio together and started learning how to just entertain the troops, you know, on the basic level. Just on the DNA type level, and, and black audiences, white audiences, mixed audiences. A lot of times in the Deep South, the juke joints are the most integrated places out there.
Yep, and the least integrated is church.
Yep, there you go. There you go. And so, you know, there's the whole devil and God dichotomy working there. But the juke joints are a form of church, and there's a lot of them. The further you get stray from the Deep South, the less little clubs there are, the less little dives, the less you can just say, hey, I got this old gas station. Let's sell cold beer and cook some barbecue and have a band up in there.
Yep.
You know, it's just more hassle the further you get away from the Deep South with all that. So I just got a little blues trio together. This was on the heels of my work with Buddy Guy. I felt sort of emboldened. I felt more that I had more experience with the blues because I was scared to mess with the blues for a long time. I privately practiced it. I privately learned the way to play it, but I didn't feel like it was my place to do that. And even though part of me said, wow, it'd be great to just get a band and play Dust My Broom, you know, it'd just be fun, or play whatever, but I didn't do it. I resisted that urge. After the Buddy Guy stuff, I felt like I had something to offer. I'd been through, you know, 3 years with him in the studio and on the road, and I said, I'm jumping into it, you know.
How did you end up working with Buddy Guy?
Well, again, it was a Mississippi connection. I was up in Carolina. He had been scheduled to make this record called Sweet Tea, which is a producer named Dennis Herring, and his who is a Mississippi native. Dennis had opened a studio in Oxford, and he had picked me to be the band leader and the guitarist for Buddy's project, Sweet Tea. And he had picked me out just from referrals of other studios, other producers that had worked with me.
Ah, so y'all didn't know each other.
We did not know each other, so just all of these producers that recommended me had produced Squirrel Nut Zippers records, but knew privately my interests, my ability, you know, just from me hearing me sit around and practice, or hearing me at a little jam session or something, you know, when we're just goofing off. So several people pointed to me and said, Jimbo is your man for this blues project, and that's what ended up happening. So, you know, I just really hunkered down after I moved back here. Stayed busy, stayed working, stayed in the clubs, learning how to handle the juke joints, and having fun. It was just a great time. And that just kept me focused on the blues, kept me focused on the South, the culture that's going on around me. And it also kept me closer to people like Jim Dickinson, Luther Dickinson, Alvin Hart, and all these artists that I was able to produce through my little janky studios, you know. just new people coming in every week. Just local cats, people from Alabama, people from Georgia, Mississippi, coming in and just surprising me with their with what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to care about their music too, you know. I was able to put my hands on it and have it go through me. And so it was just, I was just stayed constantly busy, you know, with the music.
Creatively, as someone who also, you've spent a lifetime writing your own stuff, how does working with someone else's music spark that for you?
Oh, it's great. I mean, you get their perspective, because I get a lot of people are drawn to me because I am original. They could go anywhere else and get something else. So they come to me because they are doing original stuff. they are trying something. So I get to hear their perspective, you know. I get to see their process while I'm telling them tape's rolling. That's basically what I do. But I encourage them. I get involved. I help them arrange their stuff. So mm-hmm. I get my hands dirty in their music, and that's what they want from me. So it's like I was joined all these bands, hundreds of bands, you know, between like 2004 and up to the present. You know, I've been a member of hundreds of bands via the studio. And so I absorb little tricks, and I absorb little all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm.
From the years of doing that, what really came in that just made you go, yeah?
Oh, God, so many things. I mean, just here recently out of Charleston, South Carolina, Bottles and Cans blew my mind. Great, great, great lyrics. Impassioned band, love Bottles and Cans. Hello, it's Jimbo Mathis. Frankly, one that blew me away the most was Elvis Costello and the Imposters, his band. So professional, so tight. One take. They love the, you know, you would think after all the years and all the highbrow things that he's been involved with, that he would come in and be stuck up and be, he wanted the one old mic. He wanted the band to do it in one take. And they blew me away.
Yeah.
Great band. Wonderful. Just the most professional, coolest people. The list goes on and
sure.
on. I mean, Bottles and Cans, I think, just came out. So that's probably the most recent thing. It's pretty fantastic, you know, when somebody just comes in out of the blue and it's like, okay, here we go. I'm setting up the mics. And then they launch into the first number and you're just like, wow, this is ecstatic. Another great, Robin Wojtka. He's from up in Canada.
Hmm.
He had this beautiful song called Rot Dust about his coal mining culture up there where he lives in Canada. Fantastic. Gives me chills to listen to it.
Yeah.
You know, just great song, Rock Dust by Robin Wojtka. It goes on and on. It's too much to even name.
Meanwhile, though, it's not like you've stopped recording yourself either.
Correct. Right, right.
I think I have 3 records in the last 3 years, maybe?
Probably so. Probably so. Something like that. Last year, that was Tri-State Coalition Confederate Buddha. That was my most recent project.
What's the transition from the Tri-State Coalition one to now?
Well, it's still the same group. You know, I've been working with these same guys here for coming up on 8 and 10 years, some of them. I've been with the same band here coming up on about 8 years now.
Wow.
So Justin Showa, mm-hmm. Matt Pierce from Arkansas, those two have been with me for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So the transition between the Buddha, the new record's called Blue Light. That's a collector's, it's a 10-inch EP.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's vinyl only, but it's a blue vinyl.
Cool.
Very cool, yeah, and 6 original songs on there. And it's just a continuation, you know, it's a mixture of soul, honky-tonk, blues, southern rock, and just I just keep mixing it up in different ways. You know, this one's got some nice pedal steel on it, some super funky stuff, and so it's just a continuation, you know, of what I've been doing. Some pretty, I think, some interesting songs on this.
Just because I happen to like the tactile aspect of music, what made you decide to go vinyl?
Well, I was approached by Bruce, you know, and it's actually on their vinyl component. It's called Big Legal Mess.
That's awesome.
I love the name. Big Legal Mess is my new label. And
I love it.
Yeah. They approached me. They're based here in Oxford, you know, where I live. They approached me about doing a record. I went in their studio, and actually it was nice to just turn it over to somebody else that's produced at their place. I used the same techniques, ribbon mic, just the engineers from Muscle, worked at Muscle Shoals. So they do it the real southern way, you know.
Right.
So it's got a cool original collage on the front and this translucent blue vinyl. It's going to be pretty nice. Mm-hmm.
So were you involved in the visual design process of this?
Yes, ma'am. I do my own covers, you know. I do my own album covers with art collage and different found stuff that I use. So, yeah, this one has a nice cover. It's got a 66 Dodge Charger and floating over the Mojave Desert. It's,
cool.
It's pretty nice.
Cool. I am into found object art and collage. I mean, I'm not sure that that's a technical term, but that's what I call it.
I don't know what you call it.
But
my grandma used to call it cutting out paper dolls. You know, I mean, you cut out stuff at the Sears catalog.
That's right. That's right. Well, this isn't just like a hobby for you.
No. Well, no, ma'am. Not really. You know, I mean, I studied visual art, you know, on my own. It's something I've always done, drawing and, you know, sketching things.
Mm-hmm.
And It's not my main focus, but I usually take the time to do my album covers. And if you look on my website on jimbomathis.com, there's a page that's got some original art on there that you can check out. You know, your listeners can check out.
Right.
Just always combined and intertwined in my mind. I know it sounds weird, but they're never separate to me. I think the most visual thing I've ever put together was Squirrel Nut Dippers. I mean, that combined really all the, from painting backdrops, we had the full thing, you know.
Yeah.
It'll probably never be that visual again, but, you know, I would love to do, like, illustrated books. I would love to do more drawing and more painting and stuff, but it just gets to be a matter of time. I always take the time to do my covers, you know, so you can look on Confederate Buddha and see one of my collages on that. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, it needs to make sense, you know, and that's what I tell my clients at the studio. It's like, don't do a cheesy cover. Let me do it before, you know, you just give it to some half designer and have it look like... You've taken all this time, make a good cover. And a lot of times they do listen to me.
That's a glass half full way of staying, Matt.
As far as the Big Legal Mess record, it's going to be coming out in July. And then this fall, you know, I've got a full length coming out that we took the time to do a Kickstarter campaign for. Uh-huh. We raised about $16,000 to pay for this incredible producer. So I took my hands off this last one. It's going to be called White Buffalo, and it's all original stuff. He has done some great things with, like, Steve Earle and, of course, his own groups that he's had. He's about 10 years older than me, mm-hmm. and just very, very enthusiastic about my music. Kind of came forward and really wanted to get his hands on it. It made me excited. It's called White Buffalo, and it'll be out this fall.
Gotcha. Was it tied in with the birth of this White Buffalo?
Well, it predates that. I mean, the song was recorded over a month ago. It was written, I wrote it because we had a white buffalo die here in Mississippi.
Really?
Yes, we did in Tupelo. We had one die last fall.
Oh.
And, you know, there are one in millions.
Right.
Okay, now this one over here was named Takota.
Uh-huh.
And that's a crossing of the name Tupelo, which is where it lived, and Lakota, where the white buffaloes are held especially safe. This thing that happened last week is just blew my mind. You're talking about the incident in Texas.
The birth of the one in Texas that has just been murdered.
Week.
I know. It's horrible.
Yes, it's I can't believe someone could be so ignorant.
No, I can't either.
And soulless. So the whole the white buffalo thing was really based off of Takota.
Okay.
He was gored or just wounded in a fight over on the ranch where he lived, and his wounds, they couldn't get him to get well, and he died. And to me, that was honoring in the song. Well, the whole thing that happened last week is just coincidence, and I'm not sure what to think about it, but it's heartbreaking. But the song, you know, itself, White Buffalo, is probably my greatest song I've done, you know.
Wow.
It's very heavy.
The white buffalo is not an albino buffalo. It is a very rare genetic occurrence.
Correct. Being the buffalo sacred to Native Americans, mm-hmm. the white ones are especially, it was prophesied that this calf would be born. His great-grandson started this buffalo ranch, and one of the first animals born was a white buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And his great-great-grandfather had told him, a white buffalo will come,
yeah.
and this is what it will mean. And so the odds of all of that just went up even more into the billions. Mm-hmm. And then to have this thing, I contributed money to the reward, you know, to find this person. And it's up to like $45,000 reward. And this just happened. But the song is more just in honor of the idea that animals can be important things on earth.
Mm-hmm.
They can be symbols of hope for people to gather around, and they can fulfill prophecies and stuff. Well, how this pans out, we'll have to see.
Yeah.
But it's devastating. I'm sure it's devastating to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
By the time that record is out, I think that will be a real powerful vehicle.
I hope so. I hope that it has some use. I mean, that's my best goal as artist, is to be useful somehow on mm-hmm. earth, you know. And of course, just making people happy, making people have fun, cut loose. Yeah, that's number one job as far as I'm concerned.
Sure.
I'm not this kind of self-introspective, mopey music. That, you know what I'm saying? There's a place for that as well. I'm not putting that down. But
yeah.
My kind of music is more about sort of release, having fun. But also, to be useful would be the greatest honor for mm-hmm. one of my songs, you know.
I appreciate it. Take it easy.
Yes, ma'am. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Country Fried Rock. Find the full playlist from this episode on countryfriedrock.org. Check us out on iTunes. No music, just talk.
Our theme music is from The Full Tones.
Our Country Fried Rock stinger is from Steve Soto and the Twisted Hearts. Country Fried Rock.
Copyright 2012
by Lily Pad Productions. All rights reserved.
Ever he been helping us from Country Fried Rock?
Hey, y'all, it's Sloane Spencer. Thanks so much for finding all these new old episodes of Country Fried Rock. I've got something completely different available these days called Sleep with Rockstars. And it all started from a listener comment back in the very early days of Country Fried Rock who said, you know, I slow these down to 75% and fall asleep to them. And I was like, well, over the years, I started thinking about it. And I recently started Sleep with Rockstars. The Gen X Sleep Podcast, and you can find it at sleepwithrockstars.com or your favorite podcast app.